honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode marking 80 years since the Battle of Tarawa in the Pacific. Before we get the unique perspective of a filmographer whose work on Tarawa led to an Academy Award, let's hear from another one of those 18,000 Marines that converged on that tiny outpost in the Gilbert Islands. Nebraska native Laverne Coulthard actually experienced his 21st birthday on Tarawa on the final day of that four-day battle, later referred to as 76 hours of hell.
76 hours. I mean, you never got any rest, but it was over fast. But they had about 5,000 men on Tarawa, and we was one division. Only four prisoners were taken. It was an Imperial Marine Navy people that occupied that island, and they fought to the death. They didn't surrender. The ones that were surrendered and understood there was four were wounded, couldn't help themselves. About the reef that surrounded the island, they couldn't get us in landing boats, and we had to wade in. And that's where we got chewed up bad. But their emplacements were all underground. And, of course, naval gunfire and bombing didn't bother them, you know. They were there. So you had to just go in and burn them out and with flamethrowers and hand grenades. And that was difficult, too, to get close enough to work that stuff. But it was a bad battle. In fact, I think it was the worst battle the United States had ever fought at that time, from what I heard. And we got a presidential unit citation. We had to transfer. We couldn't get over the reef in Higgins' boats. So we waited. The first wave went in Higgins' boats and what in Amtrak's. And what got back with our Amtrak's picked us up, took us in, but they had learned they couldn't go too close. We're getting machine gunned all the way in and mortared and so forth. And so they told us to get out. We had to wade in. I imagine I probably waded in 300 yards, maybe. And didn't never expect to get there, you know what I mean?
Well, were there guys falling left and right in front of you? I mean, did you see guys get hit on your way in?
When I went out of the Amtrak, the kid in front of me got hit. Kid behind me got hit. When I got in the water, one on each side of me went down dead, and by then, you don't pay attention. You just try to get to that seawall. And no more than got to the seawall, you get our breath a little bit. And some sergeant or lieutenant or somebody said, everybody is in wounded over the seawall. So away we went. We went over the seawall, and then we got into the middle of it.
And that was just the beginning of 76 hours.
But we survived, some of us. There's no atheists, they say, in foxholes. That's true. But I tell you, you don't have time to be afraid at times. You just know you're going to get killed, so you go do what you can do. And that's the way I approached it.
Again, more than 1,000 Marines gave their lives in less than 4 days of the battle for Tarawa, another 2,000 wounded. And there to document it, a Marine Corps film crew. Bill Kelleher's unique assignment as a filmographer there put him in even more danger when it came to Tarawa's infamous coral reef.
It was the thing that caused so much damage to our troops, or so many deaths and wounds and so forth, because the Amtrak's got hung up on the reef, on the coral and one thing and another, and we had to walk in about 600 yards to shore, and the beach where I landed, they had us being fired on from both left and right sides and the front. So, you know, just all kinds of crossfire, and there were so many guys that they never did reach shore. They died in the water before they even got to land.
Here you are trying to get onto the island, wading through 600 yards of water. These guys are crouching down to try to avoid the bullets, and you couldn't do that. Tell us why not.
Well, my buddy Norm Hatch and I, we had to walk standing up because we had camera belts and all with the cameras and film and everything. And we couldn't duck down because we would ruin the film, and then that there would be no reason for us to even try to get ashore. So we just we were really walking bullseyes, I thought. But the thing that we never have understood is that with all the guys that got killed and hurt and some of them blown apart and some of them just ripped apart by machine gun fire and one thing and another. He and I never got a scratch. In fact, in all of the invasions we made, none of us had any kind of serious wounds other than Ray Majasek on Saipan lost a leg. The very first thing that I saw, you know, after we got on the shore, we had a beachhead of, I don't know, you know, 15 or 20 feet, I don't know, but in off to the side in front of me, a Marine had been hit, and a Navy corpsman was treating him, and one of the snipers got the corpsman right through the cheek, you know, and God, he just started bleeding, and he put his hand up and drew it away, and it just covered with blood. He reached into his pack, and he got one of those heavy bandages they have, and he put that up on his face. You know, he just patted in place, and it stuck. And he went back and worked on the Marine. I said, I thought that was the very first thing I saw like that. I said, God, that guy needs a medal. As far as I was concerned, he would have had one. And that sort of thing happened frequently. So those guys were tremendous. They really they just did a whale of a job. A lot of guys survived because of the work that they and doctors did.
Well, and the work that you did was important too. I want to talk a little bit more about that in a second. First, I don't want to gloss past this. Here you are wading through the water. I imagine that water wasn't Pacific blue. It probably had a pretty good red tint.
It was red in a lot of places, up near the shore especially. It was turning red. You know, the bodies were floating in the water up there. Just so many guys that got hit, and they couldn't make it. And well, some of them, of course, were dead. And but the bodies were floating, and there was a lot of blood to flow too.
And that couldn't have been encouraging for you or anybody around you. What goes through your head? Do you think, what am I doing here? How am I even going to think about getting this camera out of my pack and shooting some film here?
Well,
what am
no,
I doing?
I tell you, these are things, I don't know, Paul. I think that the adrenaline must be flowing rapidly or excessively rapidly, because you don't stop to think about that, because you're supposed to be getting pictures of the action, and there certainly was plenty of action there, and so that's what we were doing. After it was over, you know, you sit down and stop and think about it, and you know, my God, how did I get through that, or how come I didn't get touched, and all these other guys, things happened to them. You know, it's a funny feeling. But when it actually was going on, I really don't think that we thought about it.
Didn't really have time to, I guess.
No, that's right.
What did you do? Did you try to find a place with a little bit of cover and just...
Well, you tried, but there wasn't very much cover on that island. You know, it was only a mile and a half long and a half mile wide, and golly, I mean, there just was no elevation to it at all. The highest point on the island was the Japanese, what was the headquarters, and it was like a huge, a very heavily enforced room that rose up possibly 15 to 20 feet, and that was the highest spot on the island.
This is this reinforced blockhouse that you've seen pictures of?
That thing, it had sloped sides, and they used coconut logs that were crisscrossed, and then in cement. They were about 8 feet thick, and before we landed, the Navy just bombarded the living daylights out of the thing. You know, I mean, they were shooting 1,000-pound shells over there, and they didn't make a dent in that thing. And the way we finally got them out, or the way the troops finally got them out, was dropping hand grenades and charges down the air vents and smoke, you know, to smoke them out. And then when they came out, they got shot. But the bombardment just didn't phase that thing. You talk about armor plate, boy. Those coconut logs and that cement, they were really something. And the guys, the Japanese came pouring out of there. There was one entrance that I guess was the only entrance to it, because that's where they all came out, and they just were sitting ducks at that point. I mean, they didn't stand a chance. Throughout the island, the Japanese were masters at digging in, you know, and camouflaging, and you don't know they're there. They were using smokeless powder, and guys are getting popped off, and you didn't know where the fire was coming from, because there was no smoke when the shells were, you know, when the bullets were shot, or when they were shot, and you had to dig them out. We used flamethrowers in most of the places, you know, to force them out, and as I say, when it was all over, they just had the 17 of them left.
It's hard to believe. I want to talk a little more about what you were doing all this time and how much you actually got to roll film, because you didn't have that much film. What was it, about 20 feet of film in each roll?
No, 100.
100 feet.
100 feet, yeah. But the cameras we were using, they were IMO three turret lens cameras, 35 millimeter film, 100 foot spools, and they were hand cranked. And, you know, you'd be filming, and all of a sudden you have to stop and crank up some more. Later on, we had the ones that would just keep going, but those cameras at that time were hand crank deals, and so you only got a few minutes of shooting, you know, with a crank, and then you had to stop and do it again. So it was a case of one guy, if he ran out, the other guy would load up and shoot, and or be shooting, and then the fellow would reload his camera. We just went back and forth, you know, that way, so that we tried to get all the action all the time, didn't lose anything.
Are there some specific images that stick out in your mind, or pieces, sequences of film that you captured, that you saw through your lens? You talked about the corpsman getting hit in the face, having half his face blown off, but you weren't rolling film on that yet. Tell us some of the things that you did see.
Hadn't gotten my camera out. Hadn't gotten my camera. That would have been one of the crackerjack things to have, because after that, most of the stuff that we saw was just the battle itself. There was one spot where Norm Hatch was my buddy, and he got a few frames of Japanese and American troops firing at one another. This was up at that blockhouse, and I think that was the only film shot during the war, as far as I know, where it showed both sides in the same frames shooting at one another. Most of it was you shooting at them, them shooting at you, but not at the same time, and showing both of them. And it just was quite a spectacular shot. And
did you ever have any moments where you're shooting something and you almost got shot, or you were a little too close to the action, had to find another point of view?
The bullets were, I mean, you know, they probably were very close to me, but when you got your eye up there, that eyepiece, and you got one eye in the eyepiece, the other eye's closed, I guess, and you don't realize that. Once in a while you'd hear something whistling by, but you didn't know whether it was real close or to the side of you. But as I say, someone was sure looking out for us, because we were in the thick of it and never got touched. It must have been close. I mean, that was a Tarawa. I had a couple of close ones other times, you know, during the war, but that one was the one that I never will understand how we got through that one that way without being hit.
It is pretty hard to fathom. As for those moving pictures Bill Kelleher captured on Tarawa, they were shown to President Roosevelt, who thought all of America should see it. With the Marines at Tarawa became an Academy Award-winning documentary that also helped sell war bonds.
It was shown throughout theaters throughout the United States, and I guess that it really did jack up the sales of bonds and so forth. And after the war was over, Norm and I found out that the film had been given a special Oscar at the Academy Awards in 1944. We didn't even know about it. The award went to the Marine Corps, and the Oscar went to General Smith, who was the commanding general, and it in turn ended up in the museum at Quantico, in the Marine Museum. That's where it is now, although the thing went to the division and all that. We were pretty happy about the fact that we were involved in it.
Because metal was needed for the war effort, that 1944 Oscar awarded to the Marine Corps was actually made out of plaster. I have the film With the Marines at Tarawa linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, where you can also link to the full-length original interviews with each of the six Tarawa survivors we heard from on today's program. One final note, as we mark the 80th anniversary of that battle this week, some of those more than 1,000 Marines who gave their lives in that four-day clash have yet to have their remains identified. Government researchers continue to work through that process to make sure those Gold Star heroes are properly honored and their families find the closure they deserve. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.